This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Saudi Arabia on Friday to discuss energy supply, human rights, and security cooperation on a trip designed to reset the U.S. relationship with a country he once pledged to make a pariah on the world stage. Energy and security interests prompted the president and his aides to decide not to isolate the kingdom, the world's top oil exporter and regional powerhouse that's been strengthening ties with Russia and China. But as President Biden was leaving Israel for Saudi Arabia, the U.S. National Security Advisor dampened expectations of any immediate oil supply boost to help bring down a high cost of gasoline and ease the highest U.S. inflation in four decades. U.S. President Joe Biden's first Mideast trip ends in Saudi Arabia, and his meetings there may determine whether the journey was a success or failure. Sagar Magani has more.
While running for office, he vowed to treat the Saudis as a pariah for their human rights record, and as president, signed off on a U.S. intelligence community finding that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman likely approved journalist Jamal Khashoggi's killing. Today, the president will meet with, among others, the man known as MBS. Khashoggi's fiance tells the AP, in the process, the president will lose his moral authority.
It's a heartbreaking and disappointing.
The president has not committed to bringing up Khashoggi's death in talks with MBS. And while he says human rights are always a topic with every leader, this visit is much broader.
To promote U.S. interest.
While healing a rift with the Saudis as the world's oil supply hangs in the balance. Sagar Magani, Washington.
This is VOA News. A German court has convicted a military officer who posed as a Syrian asylum seeker of plotting to attack prominent politicians. The court sentenced him to 5 years in prison. The Frankfurt State Court on Friday convicted the defendant of preparing a serious crime meant to endanger the state and violations of weapon laws, among other offenses. It also found he has right-wing extremist views. The 33-year-old German came to the attention of authorities after he was arrested in February 2017 while going to retrieve a pistol he had stashed in a Vienna airport bathroom. Britain's Met Office has issued its first-ever red warning for exceptional heat. AP correspondent Karen Chamas explains.
The weather agency has said that expected record temperatures will put even healthy people at risk of serious illness or death. The warning covers the next 2 days when temperatures may reach up to 104 degrees for the first time ever. The highest temperature ever recorded in the UK is 101.7 degrees. Scientists have warned that the UK will continue to experience high temperatures in the coming years, with the hottest areas being in the southeast of England. I'm Karen Chamas.
Some U.S. school districts are building housing to attract teachers, the AP's Ed Donahue reports.
In the San Francisco area, school employee Taylor Garcia and her family were finding it hard to make ends meet.
Do we have to leave the Bay Area? Can we stay here? We were kind of floating in the unknown.
The Jefferson Union High School District in San Mateo County has set up educator housing.
Now we have a three-bedroom, and it has a lot more space. More closet space, more space for the kids and their things.
Monthly rent runs from $1,400 for a one-bedroom, about $2,400 for a three-bedroom. Andy Lai with Jefferson Union High School District says they've had a big turnover in staff.
And this is a way for us to be able to retain and recruit.
Teacher Lisa Raskin moved in. She's saving on rent and can walk to work.
I don't know why they didn't do it sooner.
A study found the average teacher could afford 0.2% of homes in San Francisco, none in Silicon Valley. I'm Ed Donahue.
Recapping our top story, U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Saudi Arabia on Friday to discuss energy supply, human rights, and security cooperation on a trip designed to reset the U.S. relationship with a country he once pledged to make a pariah on the world stage. Energy and security interests prompted the president and his aides to decide not to isolate the kingdom, the world's top oil exporter and regional powerhouse that has been strengthening ties with Russia and China. Find more at voanews.com. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Togo's Armed Forces spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Sama Suso, in a statement read Thursday night on state Togolese television, TVT, and carried live on their YouTube channel, confirmed the military accidentally killed seven teenagers.
That was reporter Matteo Frashin Kofi on the deaths of seven teens in Togo when a military aircraft mistook them for Islamist militants. Details coming up. Also, Gallup survey shows five countries in the Sahel region are more connected to the internet today than they were before the COVID-19 pandemic. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Ugandan authorities say hundreds of people may have died because of severe food shortages in the country's Karamoja sub-region in the past 3 months. More than half of the population faces severe hunger, with about 200 on the verge of death. Regional leaders are calling for help to save lives. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
This week, more than 20 people in one village in Kotido district in Uganda's Karamoja sub-region died after eating wild cassava to cushion their hunger. Paul Komol Lote is the Kotido district chairperson.
This is not a normal cassava which is good for human consumption. But because of desperation, because of lack of what to eat, people resort to eating this type of wild cassava, thinking that it will at least provide a meal for them.
Farmed cassava, when properly cooked, is safe to eat, but uncooked cassava is toxic. The most affected families are in the Moroto, Napak, Kabong, and Kotido districts. Ambrose Honoria, the Kotido resident district commissioner, says hunger most affects children under age 5, the elderly, and the disabled.
From 1 year to 5 years, they do not go to school. They are very young. They are at home. So they are also those. They are also prone to hunger. The others have got energy. They can come to town. The others, the males who are above 18, go to raid. Some of them actually go and break into people's homes. Some of them go and take food by force. The women and girls can at least go and work for labor where they get paid and they can buy some food. Unfortunately, we have had food being distributed, but it's only the energetic people who usually can access or move to the centers.
Nakut Faith is a legislator from the sub-region. She says on average they bury at least two people who have died of hunger every day.
I visited some villages where I found a burial of a family of three. They had all died to starvation. As of last week, by Friday, documented deaths in Napak that had been verified were 46. In Kabong, there were 189. In Moroto, there were 45. In Kotido, they exceeded 300. The food security report puts people at risk at a number of 518,000 people waiting to die if no action is taken.
Officials say nearly 20% of the population is now malnourished. Although Karamoja is generally food insecure because it is semi-arid, the drought, cattle rustling and skyrocketing commodity prices have worsened the situation. Everest Biko is the head of programs and field generation for the World Food Programme's Karamoja region.
Across the 9 districts of Karamoja sub-region, the cost of food increased tenfold, and especially maize and beans, which is like the staple food. And that makes it nearly impossible for ordinary households to afford the cost of food.
The government has earmarked about $36 million for the food crisis in the Karamoja sub-region. Esther Anyakun is the state minister for relief and a legislator in the region.
We have been talking to the leaders here to be able to support the locals in beneficiary identification because it is very, very painful for a person to die of hunger when we, the government, are there to help them and also support them in terms of food relief.
Karamoja sub-region is one of the poorest regions. 66% of the population lives in poverty, more than three times the national poverty rate. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Thank you.
Authorities in Cameroon say thousands of vehicles have been halted by scarcity of fuel caused in part by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Cameroon's government says it's been forced to spend nearly $500 million in fuel subsidies since Russia's February invasion, as Western sanctions have hindered trade with Moscow. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
More than 100 drivers park a filling station in the Etudi neighborhood of Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, Friday, honking their horns to protest a fresh fuel shortage. The drivers say their incomes have nosedived since Yaoundé ran short of fuel this month and the scarcity spread to other towns. Yves Honoré Minka is with the waste disposal company Hygiene and Sanitation of Cameroon, Hisakam, in Bolova, on the border with Equatorial Guinea and Gabon. He says the town of Ebolova and its surroundings are a mess because his company's waste and refuse collection vehicles have been halted by a lack of fuel. Minka says his company will be able to resume refuse collection only after diesel fuel becomes available. Cameroon's government says several thousand public buses, taxis and trucks are not in use because of the fuel shortage, the second one to hit the country since April. Some of the vehicles were destined for the neighboring Central African Republic, Chad, and Gabon, slowing regional trade and transport. Cameroon's energy minister, in a press release Monday, again blamed Russia and its invasion of Ukraine. Western sanctions for Russia's assault have hampered its trade and led to volatile higher prices for oil and gas. Cameroon buys more than half its gasoline from Russia, one of the world's top suppliers of petroleum products, wheat and fertilizer. Veronica Mwambembio is Director General of Cameroon's petroleum distribution company, SCDP. Speaking Friday on Cameroon's state broadcaster CRTV, she said Cameroonians should be patient.
Dans la situation actuelle, certains marketeurs
Mbio says the shortage of petroleum products is provoked by the inability of marketers to pay the surplus sums of money requested before delivery of fuel. She says banks are reluctant to exceed credit limits to marketers of petroleum products because regular loan repayments may be hindered by unpredictable market prices. Russia's invasion of Ukraine pushed global oil prices above $100 a barrel for the first time since 2014, while those for natural gas and fertilizer have more than doubled. Cameroon's government says it has already spent $485 million on fuel subsidies since Russia's invasion in February and may need to spend more than $1 billion this year. Mbio says Cameroon's president, Paul Biya, has ordered the government to immediately pay needed subsidies for petroleum products to be imported in coming weeks. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Suadi Murakzi, a Rwandan-born American who has been living in the southern Ukrainian city of Kherson, is being held captive by pro-Russian separatists. His brother, Sahali Murakzi, spoke yesterday with Team Ishmawi with VOA Central Africa Service.
First time that we found out that my brother was arrested, that was on June 8th. We were basically unable to get in touch with him. We had been in contact with him almost on a daily basis. And on June 8th, he did not pick up the phone. He did not respond to messages. And on June 9th, we learned of his missing by finding a video that was online circulating on pro-Russian media channels.
What did you think happened to him after you saw that video on social media?
We were extremely worried. We were hoping that he was arrested for some reason, but because of what's going on in Ukraine, you know, people are dying every day. We feared the worst could have happened. So our best hope that he had been arrested for God knows what.
When and how did he get there?
My brother started going to Ukraine in 2017, and in 2018, he moved there. He had been living there since 2018, and that means he did not go to Ukraine to fight or anything like that. But when the war started, the war found him there. He was already living there.
As a family, I understand what you are going through, but what are you doing right now as we speak to make sure that your brother is safe?
From the first day that we learned of his missing, we got in contact with the State Department, and the State Department connected us with the U.S. Embassy in Kiev, and they got all the information about him. We got in contact with the FBI. We got in contact with Project Dynamo, and we also got in contact with our congresswoman. So we have been trying to do everything possible to secure his release.
You say that you have contacted different people and different organizations towards this matter. Have you ever heard anything back from them?
Not exactly. We know that they are doing something, you know, silently. But every time we talk to them, they say that, you know, we are working on it. In most cases, they say that they cannot disclose, you know, information about how they do their work. We believe them. We trust. But Project Dynamo has been very helpful, because for them, they have been able to get in contact with my brother's captors.
That was Sahali Murakzi, a businessman living in the U.S. state of Minnesota. His brother, Suadi, is being held captive by pro-Russian separatists in Ukraine. He spoke with VOA's team, Ishmawi. Togo's military says one of its aircraft accidentally targeted and killed seven teenagers in the country's north, mistaking them for Islamist militants who were initially suspected in the attack. Matteo Frashin Coffee reports from Lomé, Togo.
Togo's Armed Forces spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Sama Suso, in a statement read Thursday night on state Togolese television, TVT, and carried live on their YouTube channel, confirmed the military accidentally killed seven teenagers.
Communiqué de Forces Armées Togolaises. Dans la nuit du 9 au 10 juillet 2022,
he says the military expresses its profound regret in the face of the incident and says everything possible will be done to prevent this sort of tragedy from happening again. Togo's Army Chief of Staff, General Daja Maganawe, in a written statement, said an aircraft had wrongly targeted the civilians in the village of Markba in the northern Savannah region, Stone Prefecture. The statement said the army had intelligence indicating an imminent threat of infiltration by armed groups wanting to attack local communities. Local media initially blamed the early Sunday morning blast on an improvised explosive device, pointing the suspicion at Islamist militants. The victims instead were teenagers on their way home from celebrating Eid al-Adha, Islam's festival of sacrifice, known in the Wolof language as Tabaski. Michel Douty, an independent security expert working with Togo's Interministerial Committee for the Prevention and Fight Against Violent Extremism, CPLEV, praised the army for taking responsibility.
C'est un acte de courage, un acte de bravoure.
He says it was an act of courage, an act of braveness, an act of transparency, an act caused by the desire and the obligation to be accountable and show what the army is doing in the fight against violent extremism. Togo declared a state of emergency in the Savan region in June after Islamist militants attacked near the border with Burkina Faso, killing 8 troops and wounding 13. An Al-Qaeda-affiliated group fighting in Burkina Faso and Mali claimed responsibility for the attack. They were the first recorded deaths from terrorism in Togo, a country of 8 million people on West Africa's Gulf of Guinea. Matteo Fraschini Coffi for VOA News, Lomé, Togo.
Sub-Saharan Africa remains one of the least connected places on the planet when it comes to internet access. A recent Gallup survey shows 5 countries in the region are more connected today than they were before the COVID-19 pandemic. I talked to R.J. Reinhardt, an analyst, writer, and editor for Gallup.com and for Gallup's higher education and government divisions. He started out by explaining how Gallup works.
So Gallup World Poll has basically been around since around 2005, 2006, and it's a series of interviews with individuals in at least 140 countries per year, typically closer to 160. And what it basically boils down to is there are two different modes that we use to interview people. We either interview people face-to-face, where we literally have individuals on the ground that go to random addresses, you know, throughout a country and ask a battery of questions, or we call individuals randomly on landline or mobile telephones. Primarily in Africa, it's face-to-face, although there are some countries where we still have to do phone calls. During the pandemic, we switched over primarily to doing phone calls just for health reasons. But basically, it typically is what we would consider to be a nationally representative survey of each country, which means we interview at least 1,000 people by one mode or the other in every country.
The latest is that Gallup survey shows five countries in the region are more connected today than they were before the COVID-19 pandemic, with internet access growing substantially by 10 percentage points or more between 2019 and 2021. That's the article you wrote. So basically, based on that, how did you compile that number?
When we look at basically, we looked at the 2019 data and we compared it to the 2021 data because we had those same modes for both years for most of these countries. And when we looked at answers to a specific question is, do you have access to the internet? That can be on a mobile phone, a computer, or some other device. And so basically everyone that we interviewed was asked that question. And when we compile it, we weight our responses by the demographic factors for the country, so it is nationally representative. And so as we said, when you look at it, you look at South Africa in 2019, 52% of the population said they had access to a mobile phone, computer, or some other internet-connected device. In 2021, 66% said they had access to the internet. So that's a 14-point increase there. You also had 10-point increases in Senegal, where it went from 41 to 51%. You had a similar increase in Guinea, where it went from 23 to 33%. In Sierra Leone, there was an increase from 16% to 26%. And in Nigeria, access went from 26% to 36%.
So this increased internet access in these countries, five countries, are you saying it reflects an increased investment in telecommunications infrastructure from the public and private sectors?
I mean, it's hard for us to draw any sort of causal relations, again, you know, just because we ask that question and it's very difficult to dig into that. But, you know, it does correlate with additional investment by both private and public entities in that infrastructure.
That was R.J. Reinhardt from Gallup.com speaking to me from Washington, D.C. Concerns have grown that the exit of 2,400 French troops from Mali, the epicenter of the violence in the Sahel region and strongholds of both Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State affiliates, is worsening violence, destabilizing neighbors, and spurring migration. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi talks to Emily Estelle, manager of the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project.
It's clear from the type of conflict happening in Mali that this cannot be solved from the air. So security conditions on the ground are getting worse already, and intermittent airstrikes on jihadist targets will not solve that. This would be a challenge even if coordination between the French forces in Niger and the ground forces in Mali was strong, but this is not the case. Other European forces are leaving Mali already, and relations between the Malian government and the UN mission there are deteriorating. Furthermore, the Malian military and Russian Wagner group that's now present have been accused of massacres. And so they're therefore more likely to worsen the cycle of violence in Mali than break it. And that's more than the French forces in Niger can overcome, certainly.
France would also dispatch some 300 to 400 troops for special operations with Niger troops in the border regions with Burkina Faso and Mali. Another 700 to 1,000 troops would be based in Chad, with an undisclosed number of special forces operating elsewhere in the region. French officials said the onus going forward would be on regional countries to lead the security and also focusing more on development, good governance, and education. What do you make of the combination of combating militants security-wise and good governance, development, and education?
The goal of combining the military effort with good governance is the right one, but it's far from a new goal, unfortunately, and the problem, as always, is still implementation. It's not clear to me what investments the French will really be able to make in good governance and development in the most violence-affected areas. And the regional states in question also have a lot of political, economic, and security constraints that they're going to struggle to overcome. I'll also note that the jihadist threat is changing quite quickly, particularly toward the Gulf of Guinea states. So relying on a traditional development response at this point is probably already too slow to actually stop the expansion of the jihadist threat in this area.
Coups in Mali, Chad, and Burkina Faso have weakened France's alliances in its former colonies, emboldened jihadists who control large swaths of desert, and opened the door to greater Russian influence through the mercenary groups. How did Islamist militants use political instability and military coups to expand their violent activities in the African continent?
So starting with the instability part of this, jihadist groups in the Sahel have become really quite adept at inserting themselves into local situations and exploiting them. So let's say there's an area with tensions between ethnically aligned communities over land use, and jihadists have been able to come in armed and either position themselves as a solution to the problem or, if necessary, force an agreement at the point of a gun. The more vulnerable communities just don't have the capability or the backup to resist the jihadist armed groups that are better prepared. So many of these governments in the region really aren't prepared to deal with this challenge, and the coups that we've seen have even moved them farther away from being able to address it, at least looking at Mali's case especially, where the coup has led to a more aggressive military response that will only serve to deepen the pre-existing grievances that allowed the jihadist groups in the first place. These military responses tend not to bring long-term improvements in security or governance, and even if the military can pull off a short-term crackdown on jihadist groups, they tend to do so now in a way that makes jihadists more likely to come back and strengthen over time, because the attacks on civilians on the part of some of these militaries tend to backfire.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains dedicated to strengthening freedom and human rights for the people of Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs Brian Nichols. The detention and politically motivated trials of peaceful protesters in their home countries continue as an affront to democracy, he said. In Cuba, rather than addressing the needs of its people amidst an ongoing economic crisis, the government last year launched another round of political crackdowns, charging protesters with sedition and sentencing them from between 7 and 30 years in prison. Similarly, in Nicaragua, the Ortega Murillo regime orchestrated a brutal crackdown on human rights in response to widespread opposition to the regime's policies, resulting in the death of more than 320 Nicaraguan citizens, added Assistant Secretary Nichols. The United States continues to promote democratic governance throughout the hemisphere, including in Venezuela. As the country's general elections approached in November 2021, the regime of Nicolas Maduro imprisoned more than 40 political opponents, as well as several journalists, effectively rigging the outcome of the elections. These political prisoners have been denied access to basic needs such as food, water, and medical care. Additionally, prisoners have been tortured by beatings, submersion in water, electric shock, and exposure to cold temperatures. Female prisoners report suffering sexual violence by security forces, said Assistant Secretary Nichols. The United States, joined by partners and allies across the globe, continues to press for the release of all those unjustly detained for political reasons and conditions for free and fair elections that allow Venezuelans, Cubans, and Nicaraguans to choose their leaders for themselves, said Assistant Secretary Nichols.
We remain a steadfast partner of the Venezuelan, Cuban, and Nicaraguan people as they strive to build a better future for their country, one in which their leaders respect the human rights and freedoms of all citizens.
The United States will continue to use the diplomatic and economic tools at our disposal to support Cubans, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans in their quest for greater freedom, government accountability, and democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.